Mike Leonard joins us right now. He's a federal defense attorney. And Mike, I know you're well-trained at talking quickly sometimes. We got 28 minutes, or do you think we can, or excuse me, 18 minutes. You think we can cover everything?
John, I think we can cover really fast, really fast, really fast. I think we can do it.
Good to talk to you, my friend. How's everything going?
Buddy, I'm glad you're back. I mean, when you were out, the show was in the tank. I mean,
ratings were below zero.
So thank you for coming back and saving the show, first of all.
No, no. I listened, actually. Dane did a great job. And there was no show last week, so maybe that's what you mean. It was in the tank because of some sports coverage. I wanted to start with the case that you brought up to me on the text line, which was that the Supreme Court ruled yesterday, essentially tossing out a couple convictions against a former Chicago altar person with a famous last name. Forgive me with all the news, and I've been a little distracted the last couple weeks. I didn't even know this thing happened. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I'm going to start off with a hypothetical that is from an actual Supreme Court decision in the case of United States versus Patrick Daley Thompson, who was a former city council member. He's the grandson of the first Daley mayor and the nephew of the second Daley mayor. Here's the hypothetical, John, and this was actually in the decision. A mother comes home who had baked a big plate of cookies, and all the cookies are gone, and there's like crumbs on the plate, and she says to her daughter, "Did you eat all those cookies?" And the kid replies, "I ate three cookies."
Uh-huh.
That was in the decision. To illustrate the point of, is a statement false or is it merely misleading?
Huh.
Would you consider that statement that the kid made false or would you consider it misleading?
I'd say misleading because...
Does the context matter?
Oh, that's a good one. I would consider it misleading because, yes, she probably ate three cookies, probably ate a lot more, but it's not false in that she didn't say, "I only ate three cookies," but it wasn't entirely true that she said, "I ate at least three cookies." I don't know. What's the broader point they're trying to make there?
Well, they're trying to make the point, interestingly enough, so Patrick Daley Thompson went to trial in Chicago on tax charges and also bank fraud charges. So he was convicted of all those. The decision by the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't affect the tax charges, but does affect the bank fraud charges, because what happened was he took out three loans from a now defunct bank. And in the context of investigating the failure of the bank, they discovered he had at least a loan, right? So they questioned him, federal regulators, and he said, "Yes, I took out a loan for $110,000. Now, the fact was he actually took out three loans, but he did take out a loan for $110,000. He was found guilty at trial because the jury found that that was a false statement. Okay. They argued on appeal that while the bank fraud statute specifically requires a false statement, not a misleading statement, because that's what the statute says. So the Supreme Court took this issue up and they reaffirmed the fact that, yes, the statute only covers false statements. And there may be a statement that on its face is true, but contextually still could be found false. So they reversed.
Wait, explain that.
So it goes to that cookie example, right? So the statement made by the kid that ate three cookies is a true statement, but in context may be considered to be false, right? So the weird thing is the Supreme Court reversed and sent the case back to the trial court to consider whether the statement was false. However, it's as clear as mud because they went out of their way, the Supreme Court, to say that context still matters, right? So if you consider the context of the statement, the court could still find that it was a false statement. So it clears up one issue, meaning that the statute only covers false statements, but it makes muddy, you know, what is a false statement? If the Supreme Court's saying you have to consider the context, then these statements that are on their face are true, could contextually be false. So did they really decide anything? I don't know.
I've got a headache listening to you explain that. I think I get it. So the Supreme Court essentially said, look, this law that's in place requires false statements. Misleading statements don't set that bar. But we're going to let and toss it back to the court that originally handled this case to determine whether his statements were in fact misleading or false. So they haven't made a determination as to whether they were false or not, but they have set the bar for the conviction to stand that it be a false statement, not a misleading one.
John, you were a quick study. That's exactly right. But to me, it was kind of interesting that they didn't just find, okay, if context matters, why isn't that a false statement? You know, the jury already essentially found the same thing. So, you know, some people will think it's a victory for him. It still may not end up being a victory for him.
Interesting. Yeah, I do find that interesting because jurors ultimately kind of make those determinations between was what the witness said true, false, misleading, and as a juror, I individually, and then we collectively kind of get to discuss and determine exactly what happened. It seems interesting that a specific part of the evidence is able to be appealed and then reviewed by a different reviewed by a judge after the fact as to what the interpretation of a witness or of statements in the record are. Do you kind of see what I'm asking, Mike? This seems like relitigating something that the jury already came to a conclusion on.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. I mean, I guess the defense perspective was, well, it's merely a misleading statement, and the way the government presented the case suggested to the jury that a misleading statement or an omission could be a false statement, even though the statute specifically states false statements. The point the Supreme Court also made was that there are laws, criminal laws, that say false or misleading. So they kind of clarified that the statute is only false statements, but then threw it into the muddy land by saying, well, but context still matters. So did they really advance anyone's interest? I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Usually appeals are based on, like, you know, the jury instructions were wrong or something out of the ordinary happened in terms of the process of the trial. Not necessarily kind of the interpretation that was made in the determinants of guilt. In a broader context, Mike, I think this is it seems like a little bit, like you say, it's muddy land.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. Yeah, you're right. I mean, typically on appeal, the way he went on the defense side is to show that the judge led in evidence that he or she shouldn't have, right? Or barred evidence that should have been considered by the jury. Or sometimes you have a technical legal issue like, hey, the jury instructions were wrong or improper or misleading for the jury. Something that happened with the conduct of the trial or sometimes a motion that was filed before the trial. But yeah, this to me seems interpretive because the statute already says it requires a false statement. So I don't know if we really advanced the ball at all, but if you're his attorney, you feel good because you're still in the game and you might be found not guilty. Your conviction may be vacated entirely on that count.
312 brings up a great point. When you take the stand, I don't know if this was in testimony in court or in a deposition or something, or just in his filings and the records with the bank fraud. But, you know, a lot of these things that we sign or that we swear to are to tell the whole truth, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. 312 says, hey, guys, didn't he take an oath to tell the whole truth, meaning that a misleading statement in and of itself isn't true? You know what I think that's a great point by the texter.
Oh, it's a great point. And then you got the statutory problem. If the statute specifically says it must be false, then how do we interpret if it's false? I mean, if you can't consider the context, which the Supreme Court is saying you can consider the context, then the statements he made still may be found to be false. But yeah, great points. And it's kind of fun when you listen to these arguments at the Supreme Court level, because the hypotheticals that come up, including the cookie example, are kind of fun to illustrate these legal points. You know what I mean?
They are helpful, though. I do appreciate when a judge in their statements does use examples and hypotheticals that are a little bit more plain spoken. I've always felt like Supreme Court decisions, which I love reading, and I advise people to do it if they've got the time and the ability to just kind of read. I've had to reread some sentences like 12 times to really understand what was happening. I wish they were a little more plain spoken in some of their decisions. Mike, I think it'd be a lot better for all of us to understand which way the Supreme Court rules, agree or disagree.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the problem with the Supreme Court decisions is they're often extremely lengthy. They go back to great historical detail, and they use a lot of legal mumbo jumbo, quite frankly. You know, if they could put it in plain spoken ways that everyone could read and understand, we'd all be better off. There's no question.
Okay, I want to zoom out here a little bit. The big story, one of the big stories of the week was this, did the Trump administration really go against a federal judge's orders? There was some, I don't know if confusion is the right word, but the Trump administration says, well, it was an oral order and the planes were already in the air. This is about sending some noted criminals and some other folks back to Venezuela. And people are raising a bunch of ruckus that, no, this is a violation of a court order, a federal judge's, an Article III judge's order. What's your kind of take on this whole situation, Mike, considering you work in the federal world?
Well, it's troubling. I mean, people like to use the word unprecedented, but we kind of are in an era of unprecedented times where, you know, you have administration officials saying we don't care what the judge says outright, you know, which is really troubling. And the court could certainly, number one, find the parties or party in contempt of court, which could include a fine, could include being imprisoned, could include a directive to re-bring these people back to the United States. I mean, imagine if you're someone who got scooped from the sidewalk, who wasn't supposed to be scooped from the sidewalk and put on a military plane, right? There should be some recourse to that action, right? And there should have been some judicial review in the first place, which is what they're trying to achieve. So to have the executive branch basically say, we don't have to listen to the judicial branch, is troubling. And there is recourse from the court, but as I said, you know, finding someone contempt doesn't really necessarily undo what has just happened.
Some people would say, but wait, President Biden, when the Supreme Court ruled that the student loan forgiveness wasn't allowed, President Biden did a different kind of plan to try and, some would say, work around what the Supreme Court did. Isn't that the same thing?
Not necessarily. I mean, it depends what happens. I mean, number one, the court can rule against you, and the legislative body could pass a law that gets around that. And you could say that gets around that, but that's their job, to pass laws. So that happens all the time. Also, a president could justifiably and correctly issue an executive order if they're allowed to do it, if it's within their jurisdiction. Then again, it's not necessarily getting around the ruling. It's doing something you have a power to do. This is a little different in my view, basically saying we don't have to listen to the judiciary, which I don't think any judge at any level wants to hear. Whether you're a Trump appointee or not, you don't want to hear an administration at the executive level saying, hey, we don't have to abide by what the courts say. I don't think any judge wants to hear that.
Going back just one step, we got another text from the 312 about Patrick Daley Thompson saying, hey, what about the fact that in the context of his statements, he's an attorney, a real estate attorney, an elected official who should have known better. I don't know if you can take that into consideration, someone's knowledge of what truth versus misleading may be, but I think that's a great point by the 312.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a great point. Of course, the individual, not only, even if they weren't a lawyer, they certainly knew they'd taken out other loans. They're obviously relying on the fact that they hoped the regulators didn't know about those other loans, right? And so, of course, you know, I think Loser makes a good point, and it goes to the whole point of context. In context, is it false? And since apparently, according to the Supreme Court, you can still consider context, he may have still be found to be made a false statement.
Okay, we got time for one question on the phone line. It's got to be a 30-second question and a one-minute answer. So I go to DJ on line one. DJ, you're on WGN. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is, I was wondering, what does having a new president, Trump as our president, mean for federal criminal cases in Chicago?
Do you mean like whether they can still be tried or whether the attorney general can maybe dismiss some of the cases they've already brought, something like that? Or
yeah, just what will be different in the new presidency?
Okay, so we're a couple months into the new presidency. Mike, you got a one-minute answer here. What are you thinking?
Yeah, love the question. There's been a lot of talk about this issue. There was a big story in the Chicago Tribune about the U.S. Attorney's offices in Chicago. Are they prosecuting cases, you know, consistent with other offices throughout the country? Are they doing a good job? But one of the big questions the attorneys have been talking about is what's going to be different in terms of what cases will be charged. I think we all agree that a lot of what are considered sort of street crime cases, guns, drugs, acts of violence, will be more federally prosecuted. And the traditional so-called white-collar cases where you're going after businessmen and business people are likely not to be charged. And then there's the third area of thought where most lawyers sort of agree that in terms of the political cases or corruption cases and or the white-collar cases, they're probably only going to be brought when they're clearly not an ally of the president. So that's kind of the common lore of what people are thinking. So we expect a lot of prosecutions of street crimes and probably not so much on the traditional business type cases.
Okay, Mike Leonard, great question, DJ, by the way. Mike, where can people reach you?
John, 312-380-6559, and please tell the viewers whether you have a bracket or not.
Oh, I do not, actually. I didn't have time to fill one out. I've been busy, Mike.
Oh, John, I didn't even want to ask you the question because I thought you might say that. But
I didn't want to fill it out because Iowa's not in it. You're Hawkeyes. But my Illini doing well yesterday, and I get the last word. Mike Leonard, thanks for joining us, buddy.
John, I'm not angry, but I'm just disappointed. Thank you.